Today is Monday, March 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. It was the bloodiest day of protests in Myanmar, with over 30 reported deaths. Plus, why did authorities arrest nearly 200 in Moscow?
Because it had alleged ties to a so-called undesirable organization.
And the United Nations condemns recent arbitrary killings in the Philippines. We'll have these stories and more next. In what has been the bloodiest day of protest since the military junta seized power in Myanmar on February 1st, at least 39 people, 22 of them in a suburb of Yangon, have been killed. According to the Reuters news agency, quoting the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Advocacy Group, security forces shot protesters in Yangon's Hlaing Thaya suburb, which is home to Chinese-owned factories, and imposed martial law. China is seen as supportive of the military junta in Myanmar. Reuters News says the army-run television claims security forces acted after four garment factories and a fertilizer plant were set ablaze and about 2,000 people had stopped fire engines from reaching them. A junta spokesman did not answer calls requesting for comments. On Saturday, the acting head of the country's parallel civilian government, who was appointed by deposed legislators after the military coup, promised a, quote, revolution to oust the junta. Protests are entering their seventh week after the military detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and took over power. Since then, security forces have killed 126 people, according to the AAPP, and have detained more than 2,150 as of Saturday, with more than 300 released thus far. Russia police detained more than 180 people Saturday at a pro-democracy forum. I got the details from Charles Maines in Moscow.
Well, you know, I think, you know, many people have been either are familiar or have attended, you know, conferences where you get kind of a badge and you get a pen and a notebook. I mean, it's all pretty standard stuff. This was a conference or a democracy forum for municipal deputies. So these are local politicians in Russia from opposition parties, who've managed to kind of crack through the system and win races in recent years. They were sharing sort of their kind of best practices and some strategies. That was certainly the idea anyway, for other prospective candidates who might be running in this fall's election. You know, and you had basically about, I don't know, I want to say 200 maybe participants, maybe, you know, quite a few journalists there to just check it out and see what's going on. And proceedings got underway with their first kind of, you know, roundtable discussion. It involved the former mayor of Katrinburg, a big city in Russia, a couple of independent deputies. And everything seemed to be going fine, except then about 20 minutes into it, the police stormed the hotel room. This was all in a Moscow hotel, all legitimate, nothing underground here. And they pronounced that the event was closed. It was illegal. That everyone would be arrested, including the speakers and the audience, because it had alleged ties to a so-called undesirable organization. This is part of a group that had some ties to a Russian oligarch who's been exiled and is considered an enemy of the Kremlin. And so that basically led to 200 arrests. Near 200 arrests over the day. So it's quite a remarkable kind of turn of events for what seemed to be, you know, a regular kind of conference situation.
And following these arrests, what's been the reaction throughout the pro-democracy movement within Russia?
Well, I think, you know, the key thing here is that even though there were 200 people that were arrested, they've got some court cases now to face. They weren't held for particularly long, several hours, and then released, but they'll have to go to court. And the question is, what was the purpose of this, right? Was this designed to then keep, perhaps, for example, we've seen in recent years that these municipal deputies have made some headway in races against pro-Kremlin parties, particularly the United Russia Party, which is the Kremlin's favorite party. And it seems maybe this was a way to disqualify them from future races this fall. That's just one of the theories kind of batted around the Kremlin analyst world at this point. I think it is a sense also, you've got to note that it's happening after the arrest and imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, who's now in prison for the next 2.5 years. on charges of violating his parole obligations from an old case that many people think was trumped up, essentially politically motivated. And so, you know, this, and we've also seen in the wake of protests that happened because of Mr. Navalny's arrest, over 10,000 people arrested here in Russia. So there's really an attempt to kind of intimidate, whether it's on the ballot or on the street.
Charles, you bring up Alexei Navalny. You know, what is the current status of his detention, as well as the pro-democracy movement that he is most closely associated with?
Well, they've been put on hold, essentially. You know, after, again, it was over 10,000 arrests, Mr. Navalny's allies, his chief strategist, called a moratorium until the spring. You know, you could argue that's for different reasons. I mean, one theory was that, of course, it is difficult to get people out in the streets. It's, you know, clearly there's an intimidation factor from the government saying that these are illegal protests, and we follow these arrests. On the other hand, I think there was a concern among some that should they continue to try and get people out following all these arrests, that the numbers would look small and maybe insignificant, and the optics would be bad if you're trying to play to kind of a media campaign. So they've called this off to the spring, at least, summer. Obviously, there is an international pressure campaign going on against the Kremlin. So from the U.S. and from European allies, calls for sanctions, and in fact, sanctions have been imposed against Kremlin insiders. They're thought to be involved in this case. If that's enough to change the calculus of what happens to Mr. Navalny, I think there's a lot of doubt about that. What we know in terms of with Alexei Navalny himself, he was transferred recently from a holding prison. Essentially, he was in quarantine, being transferred to an area about 150 kilometers outside of Moscow, a town called Vladimir Oblast. And he's now in what we think is a more severe prison designed to pressure political prisoners. We don't know for sure, frankly, this, because Russia's prison authority is very, very murky in terms of identifying where prisoners go. It might be some time before we get confirmation that he's where, in fact, we think he is.
Charles Maines was speaking to me from Moscow, Russia. United Nations officials are condemning the arbitrary killing of 9 activists in 4 provinces in the Philippines last week in what they say appears to be have been coordinated simultaneous police-military operations. Lisa Schlein has more.
This is not the first time such killings have taken place. On December 30th, 9 Tumandok indigenous people's rights activists were killed in Panay during similar joint operations. The UN Human Rights Office reports 8 men and 1 woman were killed in this latest joint police and military operation. Agency spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the police obtained search warrants. They were presented as part of the government's counterinsurgency campaign against the New People's Army, the armed wing of the Communist Party of the Philippines. She says they entered the activists' homes in the dead of night and shot them.
So these search warrants were obtained in this context to conduct searches for weapons held as part of the communist insurgency. However, as you pointed out, these operations were carried out in the middle of the night, and those who were killed were working on issues such as the rights of fishing communities, indigenous people's rights, housing rights of people rendered homeless or people who have been evicted from urban slums.
Shamdasani calls the near total impunity for the use of lethal force by the police and the military shocking and says it must end.
We are deeply worried that these latest killings indicate an escalation in violence, intimidation and harassment and red tagging of human rights defenders. There is a history of human rights advocates being red tagged or being accused of being fronts for the armed wing of the Communist Party in the Philippines.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warned in June of the dangers of such public labeling. She called for the protection of human rights defenders, journalists, and others at risk. However, Shamdasani says Bachelet's plea has not been heeded. She says dozens of activists and several journalists have been arrested, intimidated, and harassed since then. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Boko Haram militants have terrorized northeastern Nigeria for more than a decade, driving what the United Nations says are more than 2 million people from their homes. VOA's Haruna Shehu visited with internally displaced people in Borno State as authorities prepare to resettle them closer to home.
This is Kawarumaila, an unofficial camp in Maiduguri, where more than 3,000 people have been living for the last 7 years since Boko Haram militants dropped them from the countryside into the Borno State capital. Having escaped the Islamic extremists, they still face enormous challenges, struggling to get food and basic health care, to educate their children, to reimagine a future.
Life is very difficult. We are suffering.
Mohammed Abba had a farm in Kwandugo local government area. Now, he, his wife, and 5 children live in a single cramped room.
During the rainy season, you will be shocked to see how we must cope. This room floods and we can't sleep. I used to farm in Kwandugo, raise animals and do trading. But this is our situation today.
His neighbor, Falmata Abukar, also came from Kwandugo with her husband. She blames inadequate health care in the camp for a son going blind in one eye.
My child fell ill. He didn't open his eye for 4 days. He cannot see with that eye now. The eye is beyond repair.
Widows, most with children, live in a donated warehouse. More than 180 people in rooms marked by hanging sheets of fabric or plastic. Women often sit together in the center, chatting while sifting ground maize to make a traditional dish called biski. The camp's residents are trying to make ends meet. In daylight outside, women do needlework, crafting hats and other items to sell. So do girls who back home would have been in school. Borno State has 32 official displaced camps and roughly 200 informal settlements supported by the state and federal governments, as well as by international partners, including UNICEF, the Norwegian Refugee Council, Save the Children, and Doctors of the World. Borno State Governor Babagana Umar Zulum says authorities are working to resettle many of the displaced by year's end.
The IDPs are tired of life in the camps. They complain to us day and night about their plight. They don't have food, and their children are being exploited. They need to return to their homes.
Governor Zulum says that depends on asserting control over Boko Haram and protecting civilians.
We have to first ensure their safety. We don't want to resettle people where there is no security.
Many of the homes of displaced people were destroyed or are in areas still vulnerable to Boko Haram attack. So, for now, authorities are moving to resettle people in cities closer to home that are patrolled by security troops. Fish trader Abagana Kolomi says insecurity in his hometown near Lake Chad restricts how people can earn a living.
People cannot go to fishing. They cannot find food anywhere because no one has cultivated his farm or raised animals.
Venturing from better protected cities to fish, farm, or do other chores in Borno State can be dangerous. Last month, a group of displaced people gathering firewood near the town of Dambua were abducted and 5 killed in a suspected Boko Haram attack. Haruna Shehu, VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Last week, the United States designated 2 armed groups, one in the Democratic Republic of Congo and another in Mozambique, as terrorist organizations, resulting in travel bans and asset freezes. The U.S. says the DRC-based Allied Democratic Forces and the Mozambique-based Alus Sunnah Wajama both have links to the so-called Islamic State extremist group. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Dr. Akinola Olojo in Dakar, Senegal. Dr. Olojo is a counterterrorism expert and a senior researcher with the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies.
First, I think that it has become very clear that these groups have become a threat, not only to the immediate communities where they operate, but also to the region. And I'm focusing very specifically on the countries where they operate, but also about the fact that it's perceived, of course, by the U.S. that they are also a threat to U.S. interests.
Now, looking at the ADF in eastern Congo, they're accused of committing attacks against civilians, but of course, there are many armed groups in eastern Congo who have been accused of atrocities. Why do you think the U.S. has decided to designate this group, the ADF, as a terrorist organization?
Okay, I will say that when we look at the, I mean, the details of the designation itself, it refers to, you know, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Mozambique, ISIS Mozambique. You know, I'm quoting the exact language used in the designation. And it's framing it sort of within the context of this ISIS affiliation. And we've seen in recent years, you know, since, of course, the disintegration of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, a sort of spread, you know, in Africa. In the Sahel, for instance, you have the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. You have, of course, for some years now, the so-called Islamic State West Africa province in the Lake Chad Basin. That ISIS link or that nexus with ISIS is what really comes very clearly as a threat, perceived as a threat, of course, to the U.S. and countries affected in Africa.
And how strong or how serious do you think these links might be between these groups and ISIS?
I think the threat is there. We've had, obviously, there have been a number of attacks, communities affected by attacks. And I think what is quite striking is that I think what always occurs to me each time we have these designations is that each time it's done, we actually do not see exactly, you know, the desired impact, you know, because we've seen back in 2013, when Boko Haram, you know, groups like Boko Haram were designated, you know, as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. But since 2013, we actually have seen Boko Haram not only expand and morph into factions, but also, you know, having an increased appetite in terms of even connection with organized crime, in terms of its sources of funds and its capability in general. So I'm not quite sure if the designations even of these groups we're looking at in the DRC and in Mozambique would actually bring about the, you know, the impact or the effect which where communities actually are yearning for.
Now, recently, the U.S. in a separate conflict in Yemen actually lifted a terrorist designation for another group, the Houthis, and they did that because they thought the designation put humanitarian aid at risk to Houthi-controlled areas. And of course, that happened in Somalia, where the U.S. designated al-Shabaab as a terrorist organization, and that jeopardized aid to their areas. Is there a risk that this could happen in eastern DRC or northern Mozambique as well?
I mean, you raise a very important point here about the humanitarian dimension. I mean, I will say that there has already been that humanitarian aspect. It's of great concern already. The crisis in northern Mozambique, precisely in Cabo Delgado, I will say that, of course, the fears about the humanitarian situation even getting worse in light of, you know, the designations of these groups is also one which shouldn't be taken for granted. It can indeed worsen the situation. And not only that, I would add that it can also potentially hinder a political process or even some form of dialogue if that is explored when it comes to trying to bring about a ceasefire involving these groups or even trying to, you know, sort of address it through a political lens.
Dr. Akinola Alojo is a senior researcher with the Institute for Security Studies, and he was speaking to my colleague, Jason Patinkin. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In a study to be published by the Astronomical Journal, a group of scientists detailed their discovery of an Earth-sized rocky exoplanet that may have developed a replacement atmosphere after its original was blown away by the intense radiation from its host star. The planet, identified as Gliese 11, is said to orbit a small red dwarf star 41 light-years away from a secondary atmosphere, may have been created and continues to be replenished by volcanic gases seeping through fissures on the planet. The study suggests Gliese 1132b's original atmosphere was a thick blanket of hydrogen and helium gases. The astronomers say the planet's current atmosphere is composed of molecular hydrogen, hydrogen cyanide, methane gases, as well as an aerosol haze. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Fugitive lawmaker Ted Hoi has become the first Hong Kong politician allowed into Australia during the COVID-19 pandemic. China has accused Canberra of interfering with its domestic affairs. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
Pro-democracy former Hong Kong lawmaker Ted Hui has been at the center of some unruly scenes in Hong Kong's parliament. He once threw a bag of rotten plants into the Legislative Council chamber to disrupt a debate. He fled Hong Kong while on bail in 2019 in a case related to anti-government protests, but still faces national security charges. He went to Europe, but has been granted a visitor's visa by Australia. Australia closed its borders to foreign travellers a year ago because of the pandemic, but Hui has been given special permission to fly to the northern city of Darwin. He arrived this week with his family, and all are in mandatory COVID-19 quarantine. Hui told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that he was grateful for Canberra's support.
I did explain to the Australian government about my situations and what my family is experiencing as an exile. They granted me permission on basis of compelling and compassionate reasons. I could actually get on a repatriation flight with other Australians going home. It was very kind of the Australian government, and I'm grateful for everything it's given for me.
Hui believes he's better placed to fight for democracy in Hong Kong in exile in Australia with other like-minded activists. He's called for a stronger international response to national security laws imposed by China in Hong Kong. However, China's Foreign Affairs Ministry has accused Australia of meddling in its domestic politics and harbouring a fugitive. Relations between Australia and its biggest trading partner are at their lowest in decades. The list of disagreements is long. There has been friction over Canberra's call last year for a global inquiry into the origins of the new coronavirus and allegations of Chinese interference in Australian politics. In a sign of escalating tensions, Beijing has imposed restrictions on several Australian farm exports, including barley and wine, and on coal. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Analysts say Hui's arrival in Darwin will add more friction to an increasingly tense relationship. Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
North Korea will receive nearly 2 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine through the World Health Organization's COVAX program. Despite the country's limited resources, some medical professionals are confident that North Korean doctors can successfully carry out a vaccination campaign. But human rights advocates say Pyongyang's year-long border closure has caused a humanitarian disaster. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
The COVAX facility, a multinational program that distributes COVID-19 vaccines to middle and low-income countries, says it will provide North Korea with 1.7 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Ki Pak, director of the Korean-American Medical Association's North Korea program, says doctors there have a lot of experience carrying out nationwide vaccination campaigns. Pak explains that the AstraZeneca version is a good option because it only needs to be stored between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius, standard refrigeration temperature that the North has in its medical infrastructure. Pak spoke with VOA News over the phone from Utah.
They should be able to distribute AstraZeneca vaccine nationwide and then maintain the cold chain that's required to protect the vaccine from what we call denaturing or just inactivated. They have the technical know-how and the capacity to distribute at least the AstraZeneca vaccine in a nationwide vaccination campaign.
Pak, a neurosurgeon, says he's worked side-by-side with North Korean doctors on more than 20 trips to the country. He says despite the North's limited resources, medical professionals there do the best they can with what they have available. But Pak says international sanctions against Pyongyang over its nuclear weapons program create setbacks for the country's hospitals. Even though medical supplies are technically exempt from import bans, Pak explains that many aid groups still go through the process of vetting shipments. And he says that slows down public health campaigns.
these UN agencies just they don't take any chances. They don't want to run afoul of any problems. And they get the exemptions, to be fair. But it creates additional layer of administrative hurdles, work that has to be put in to get these things delivered.
Pyongyang credits its strict border closure with keeping out the coronavirus. North Korea says it has no COVID-19 infections, a claim that most outside observers do not believe. Seok-Kil Park, who heads the Seoul office of the human rights group Liberty in North Korea, says that during the pandemic, the regime has also enforced new limitations on domestic travel in the name of public health.
Maybe actually they've been able to control the pandemic itself with this level of draconian measures, both contact with the outside world and movement inside the country.
Park says he is worried that Pyongyang will not lift these restrictions even after the pandemic is over. The border closure has also prevented international aid workers from entering the country and has nearly halted trade with China. Park says this hurts the poorest North Koreans the most.
This is creating a massive shortage in all sorts of goods, including basic necessities. You know, we hear from contacts inside the country that things like soap and toothpaste and even foodstuffs are in shortage. And so we're very worried about hunger. From what we hear, the last year has been a disaster.
Park adds that without international monitors inside North Korea, he is concerned that the COVID-19 vaccine will not be distributed fairly. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
E-cigarettes or vaping is now one of the most popular forms of using tobacco among U.S. high school students. VOA's Faiza El-Masri spoke to one teenager who is tackling the problem of youth vaping by raising awareness about the dangers, especially during the pandemic, and providing strategies on how to handle peer pressure.
My name is Sid Thacker, and I'm a rising senior at James Madison High School. Throughout my high school life, I've seen e-cigarettes really develop. So from 9th grade, it wasn't that big of an issue, but as I moved on to 10th and 11th grade, the issue became rampant. Many kids were caught with vapes, with using an e-cigarette, and the incidence rates almost went up to 25%, so one in every four students were using one. And this was really concerning for me and my principal. From 10th grade to 11th grade, we saw e-cigarette detectors in bathrooms. We saw security patrolling the hallways, making sure kids weren't skipping class and using the bathrooms to vape in. And so we really saw how this problem became not just an issue for kids, but an issue for school security.
Now, dopamine is the main chemical that makes you hooked onto the substance. It gives you that high, and it's what makes it addictive.
My nonprofit, or Nick Report, has really strived to create a curriculum that's not just inclusive on the factors of e-cigarettes and why it's such a big problem, but we really hope to teach students ways to say no to using these e-cigarettes. One problem we really face is that kids often don't want to be using them, but are often peer pressured into using them. So the curriculum we developed for health class was really used to help educate students on the social dangers that are around it and the emotional factors around it. And we also created another curriculum in biology class. And here we really wanted to focus on educating students on the dangers of e-cigarettes internally. We focused on how e-cigarettes affect cells, how they affect our organelles. In total, we've been able to impact over 3,000 students and teachers.
If I'm able to get successful results within the mice.
We had a chance to talk to over 100 parents on exactly what I'm doing at our school and why this is such a big issue. One student that I was talking with, he was a really big athlete at our school. And after learning about the side effects on vaping, on lung capacity and how much air actually runs through his lungs, he was really shocked to see, and it really persuaded him not to be using the device anymore.
Now we're planning on actually moving to a couple of other high schools.
Sid's efforts at educating his fellow classmates and young people everywhere about the dangers of vaping is going to be critical to stopping this epidemic. From a lung standpoint or a pulmonary standpoint, there there have been up to 2,000 cases reported of what is termed vaping-induced lung disease.
We're in our pristine years, and we're at an all-time high. I'd really hate to see kids really ruin their internal body through this chemical that's really just useless.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production staff, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.